Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello, my name's Adrian Goldberg and thank you for downloading the 5 Live Investigates podcast. This week, concerns about safeguarding in sport, especially for young people. We've uncovered a startling rise in the number of referrals to the Disclosure and Barring Service about coaches, officials and volunteers working with children and vulnerable adults. But those concerns aren't always being shared across sports, leaving kids at risk.
First for news and the best live sport. This is BBC 5 Live. 5 Live Investigates.
Good morning, yes, Adrian Goldberg with you here with 5 Live Investigates today. How safe are your kids from abuse down at their local sports club? We've got alarming evidence which shows a sharp rise in the number of coaches, officials and volunteers referred to the authorities because concerns have been raised about their behaviour. There have been well-publicised allegations of historical sexual abuse in sport, especially football. But figures we've obtained show there has been a fourfold increase in referrals over the last 4 years to the Disclosure and Barring Service, which helps identify those who pose a risk to young people. Now, the DBS can't tell us how many of those referrals ultimately led to adults being banned from working with children, nor whether the behaviour that gave concern was of a sexual nature. But the numbers are staggering. 4 years ago, there were just 88 referrals. Last year, that number rocketed to 339, an increase of more than 200%. That's worrying enough, but here's something that's even more disturbing. We can reveal today that these concerns are not always being shared with governing bodies and clubs, meaning that potential abusers can go undetected. So are we doing enough to protect our children? I'd love your stories this morning, particularly if you're involved in coaching, if you take your youngster maybe to the local sports club, to the local gym, to the local swimming club. Text us on 85058. You can email goldberg@bbc.co.uk. Contact us on Twitter at BBC5Live or on Facebook where we're BBC5Live. First, the story of the predatory football coach Jonathan Bedford, who abused teenage boys as young as 13 over a period of at least 7 years. 2 months ago, Bedford was jailed for 11 and a half years for offences including rape and sexual assault. Detective Inspector Jane Parks of Lincolnshire Police led the team who brought him to justice and told me how they became aware of his activities.
The mum of one of the boys that he coached at football became concerned about some messages she'd seen on her son's Facebook account. Bedford was asking the son to send images of himself in his boxer shorts and was saying he'd pay cash for these images. And this was reported to us and obviously we were very concerned.
What did you then find out?
Well, then we very quickly arrested Bedford and seized his computers and telephones, interviewed him regarding the offence against the boy we'd identified, and then conducted forensic examination of his computer, etc., which in turn identified a number of other boys who appeared to have had contact with Bedford that was inappropriate.
Without being too graphic, overall, what did the abuse involve?
To start off with, Bedford would speak to boys and ask them for pictures of themselves in the boxer shorts and would offer to make payment for those images. Bedford himself described this as banter. But then moving on from that, he would obviously ask for naked images. And then there was the whole range of offending right up to an offensive actual rape of one of the young boys.
How did he go about grooming these young men?
Well, I think he deliberately would seem to target the quieter members of the little cohorts of footballers, the ones that were perhaps more on their own, more vulnerable. And I suppose, really, the initial contact of asking for a picture of somebody in the boxer shorts was the tester. It was sort of perhaps would raise some concerns with me, but, you know, a little bit more innocuous, and then tested the response, really. And from that response, then built up to the next level of offending.
And in some cases, the young footballers even stayed in his house. Just tell me how that came about.
He was very determined and manipulative and tenacious in his approach to these boys. And not only did he groom the boys himself, but in turn their parents. He presented as a fine, upstanding member of the community who was, you know, involved in children's sport. and would convince parents and boys alike that staying at his house was appropriate and nothing more than a coach showing an interest in their son's or that person's football career. And, you know, parents allowed this to happen without ever thinking that they were putting their children in the hands of an abuser.
Do you think that he chose football coaching as a means to carry out his activities?
Can't be sure, because he himself has never said, but, you know, it is recognised that people who do have an unhealthy interest in children often get themselves hobbies, occupations or other methods by which they can get privileged access to children, where they can groom and gain the trust of children. So it wouldn't be unusual for that to be the case, but we can't say for sure, because obviously not every adult who works in this area has got unhealthy interest in children, and many do it for the right reasons.
There we go. Detective Inspector Jane Parks from Lincolnshire Police on how one coach abused his position in sport. Jonathan Bedford's conviction means that on his release, he will be automatically banned from working with children by the Home Office-funded Disclosure and Barring Service, or the DBS. But not all cases are as clear-cut as that. What happens if members of a sports organisation have serious concerns about the behaviour of a coach or volunteer, but who has never been convicted? Well, they can send their evidence to the DBS, who would look at the case, then decide whether the individual concerned should be barred. And as we've discovered, these kinds of concerns have been raised with increasing frequency. Let's get more now from our reporter, Anna Rigg. So what do we know, Anna?
Well, we submitted a Freedom of Information request to the DBS, which covers England, Wales and Northern Ireland, about sport and recreation. So as well as the sports clubs, that could include leisure centres and so on. They couldn't tell me specifically how many sports coaches had been referred in this way for concerns relating to children and vulnerable adults, but they gave me the figures for the sport and recreational sector as a whole. So for the financial year of 2012 to 2013, there were 88 referrals. But in 2015 to 16, that jumped up to 339 referrals. So that's a 285% increase. In fact, those most recent figures are actually the highest since the DBS came into existence.
So do we know why were these people referred to the DBS?
Well, the DBS couldn't tell us that. What we can say here, though, is that we're not just talking about wild rumours or allegations of suspicious behaviour. The DBS told us referrals should be made when an organisation has permanently banned someone because they've harmed a child or a vulnerable adult, or they pose a risk of doing so. So even where an individual hasn't been banned or suspended, an organisation would normally be expected to carry out their own investigation first to gather evidence.
So as you say then, this isn't just kind of a whisper and a rumour going round the dressing room. These are cases where someone's behaviour has given cause for genuine concern and where children might be at risk, or vulnerable adults as well. Yep. So how many of those people were eventually barred from working with children and vulnerable adults?
Well, again, they couldn't provide that information either. They said it would cost too much for somebody at the DBS to manually inspect all the individual case records. But what we do know is that the previous safeguarding organisation, the Independent Safeguarding Authority, only barred 1 in 10 of all the people referred to them.
So in the 9 out of 10 cases where action isn't taken, can that information, which could reveal serious concerns about an individual, then be shared with other sporting organisations and clubs?
No. The DBS can only share information if somebody has been barred.
So there could be genuine concerns about an individual, a coach, a volunteer, a club official, but people in other clubs and other sports just wouldn't know about that. So what have the DBS had to say about that?
Well, we did ask them to come onto the programme, but they didn't have anyone available. But they sent us a statement, and in the statement they told us, those who commit the most serious offences against children and vulnerable adults are automatically barred from working with them. We will not compromise on safeguarding. The processes used by DBS are robust and designed to protect those most vulnerable in our society.
Anna, for now, thank you. Very keen to get your reaction to this morning. Maybe you're involved in coaching down at the local football club, down at the local swimming pool. Maybe you are, like me, a parent who has children who are currently being coached. What do you make of what you've heard so far? You can drop us a text at 850 58, email goldberg@bbc.co.uk, or on Facebook, BBC 5 Live. It's 14 minutes past 11.
Across the UK,
this is BBC 5 Live. 5 Live Investigates.
Now, just a quick update on the cricket. England taking on India in the first one-day international in Pune. England are batting first. They are currently 305 for 5 in the 47th of their 50 overs. Live coverage continues over on 5 Live Sports Extra. This morning on 5 Live Investigates, we've uncovered a massive increase in the number of people involved in sport who have been investigated by the government's Disclosure and Barring Service because of concerns about their behaviour. 4 years ago, there were just 88 referrals. Last year, that rocketed to 339. And as we've been hearing, referrals aren't just made on the basis of rumour and speculation. They should only be made when an individual has already been banned from an individual sport or where that sport has gathered evidence and carried out its own inquiry. Now, Alan Roberts was one of British judo's leading coaches. He had trained Olympic medalist Kate Howie, but he was later banned from working as a coach for life by the British Judo Association after a disciplinary hearing found that he had abused 5 athletes, 2 of whom were under the age of 16. Mark Costiff from Crawley was 17 when he first met Roberts.
He sort of spotted me, if you like, invited me up to his club and sort of started doing it like once a week and then just built up from there, really. If I was going to get anywhere, he was the man in the south to get me there, really.
So tell me, if you don't mind, I know this is difficult, Mark, but how the abuse happened?
As I sort of got more involved with him, training-wise, he saw in me that I was keen to sort of go as far as I could. And it was a sort of manipulation kind of process, really. You know, you would invite me up to the club for one-on-one sessions. So I was the only one sort of at the club at that time. And then if the club was busy, we'd go back to his house. I was kind of young and naive, and that's how it kind of started, really. You know, he sort of lulled me into a sort of sense of security. And if I knew that if I had to sort of better myself, then, you know, I had to kind of do what he was, you know, suggesting.
So it was a kind of a step-by-step process?
Yeah, kind of gradual over a period of 4 years, really.
What kind of impact has that had on you in the years since?
When it all come to light, it was the end of my judo. You know, I didn't want to continue in it, didn't want to go to a different club. So I thought the easiest, quickest way out was to knock it all on the head altogether, really. So it was a shame because I've always liked the sport, you know, always thought about going back, but never really done it, to be honest.
And what is the emotional impact of it being on you?
It doesn't go away. You obviously hear on the radio and TV about other people getting caught up in stuff like this, and obviously you get memories, flashbacks, but it's, you know, it's yeah, that's the worst part of it.
Well, that's Mark Costiff. Now, after the hearing, British Judo, who barred Roberts from the sport for life, sent its evidence to the DBS, the Disclosure and Barring Service, but they decided to take no further action, leaving him free to work with children as long as it didn't involve judo. Mark Costiff says he was astonished.
It's disgusting, really. You know, it really is. Half the reason why I went through that tribunal was obviously to stop him. And it's only sort of half a job been done, really. You know, it's like, say, if he wanted to become a gymnastics coach or what have you, then he could do. You know, it's a shame that the parents for other sports won't even get to know that. It won't be their choice.
What should happen if a coach is banned by one sport following allegations of abuse?
It should go onto a universal record that all the sports clubs can access that and, you know, do their homework and find out about people like him, really.
There you go. That's the story of Mark Costiff. Let's get a word with Keith Eldridge. He's the safeguarding manager for British Judo. Morning to you, Keith.
Good morning.
So in this case, the Crown Prosecution Service decided there was insufficient evidence to bring charges, but British Judo obviously decided there was sufficient evidence for you to take action.
That's right. And it has to be said, though, that sports bodies use the civil burden of proof. That's just a balance of probabilities, not beyond all reasonable doubt. So it does make it easier for us to have a disciplinary hearing. And that's exactly what we did. And I commend people like Mark coming forward. It was just really frustrating to have to go back to him and say that Mr. Roberts wasn't put on the barred list at that time.
But you banned him from judo, let's be clear, although he protested he's innocent, because you believed he was a threat to children.
That's exactly right. We held a comprehensive disciplinary hearing with some other cases against him as well. We found those proven. We expelled him from British Judo and I made the referral to the Disclosure and Barring Service.
And at the point at which you banned him, you then had to make a mandatory referral to the DBS.
That's correct, yes.
Were you surprised then when you discovered that after their investigations, he wasn't barred from working with children altogether?
Well, it's quite interesting, really, because I didn't find out. Part of the process is I make the referral, but you're only entitled to do a check with the Disclosure and Barring Service to see if someone's barred, if you've got good cause. But of course, by then, he's expelled from my organisation. I haven't got good cause to do a check on him. And as a matter of course, the Disclosure and Barring Service don't tell the referring organisation. So I only found out when Mr Roberts chose to use the fact that he hadn't been barred as grounds to try and appeal.
So the fact that you had barred him as British Judo wasn't deemed sufficiently good reason for you to check with the DBS as to whether he'd been barred from involvement in other sports.
That's correct, yeah. They don't, as a matter of course, tell organisations, although I'm told some other organisations have been told, but I don't know why they'd been told. But
yeah.
We certainly weren't.
So had Roberts applied to become a coach in another sport, would his ban from judo have come up in a check to the DBS?
No, only if he was on the barred list.
And as we've said, in his case, he wasn't put on the barred
list. That's right. So he could go on, as you say, become a gymnastics coach and they wouldn't know.
And having spoken myself this week to Mark Costiff, having heard from you now, Keith, I'm just agog at this. What do you make of this system?
I do find it quite frustrating. We, as an organisation, British Judo, spent an awful lot of money bringing this prosecution disciplinary case against Mr Roberts. As a QC that chaired the panel, this wasn't, a sort of a low-key event. This was a proper hearing over 5 days with lots and lots of evidence that we then present to the Disclosure and Barring Service. And I don't know what process they go through. I don't know whether they kind of rejudge the case or what. There's just no transparency there, so it's very frustrating.
And from your point of view then, why can't you just say, well, look, we believe there is a threat here, there's a risk to young people. Why can't you just go out and share that with other sports organisations?
It's quite tricky. I mean, it'd be really good if we could, but of course there's lots of other legislation. People have a common law right to confidentiality unless there's an overriding public interest. The Data Protection Act says that we mustn't share information unless there's substantial public interest. The Human Rights Act. So all things that currently make it difficult for us, unless we can prove an actual threat, and currently our legal advice is that we can't publish that information. So the only way we've got of sharing it is through the barred list currently.
Keith Eldridge, absolutely fascinating stuff. Thanks very much indeed. That's Keith Eldridge from British Judo. Should say, Alan Roberts has always maintained his innocence, told us that he has no intention of going back into sport. But sporting organisations do face a real dilemma when the police and the Crown Prosecution Service decide, as in cases like this, that where there is genuine concern about an individual's behaviour, but not enough evidence to prosecute. As we've heard, it's a different basis on which you prosecute through the civil court or have a hearing like the one that British Judo had compared to a criminal prosecution. Let's get a word now with Niall O'Carroll, who used to be responsible for safeguarding British gymnastics and is a former police officer. Morning to you, Niall.
Morning, Adrian.
And you've also had examples where you've had concerns in gymnastics, but where the police decided not to get involved. Just tell us what you've come across.
Just to echo some of the words that he said, and I know he's actually chaired disciplinary panels for us. When a case is raised and you carry out an investigation, or it's handed over to the police to carry out an investigation, and it comes back with the police or the Crown Prosecution Service decide not to prosecute, then you're left with a body of evidence that needs to be investigated and dealt with. And we had a very similar process to British Judo, where we gather our own evidence and we'd have a hearing where findings will be made on the suitability of the coach to remain in the sport. In a similar circumstance to Keith, we did have a situation where a coach was removed from our sport for concerns that we felt were breaches of our regulations. And this coach was referred to the GBS. But similar to Keith, we then have no right to access information to know if this coach has gone on to work in other sports. And gymnastics is a kind of a unique sport in the sense that coaches, you know, would have a direct relationship with a kid from a very young age all the way through to the Olympic level. You know, you could have the same coach your whole career, which means they build a very close bond.
So just so I'm clear, though, Niall, you had an example where there was a coach who had a sexual relationship with a young athlete, which, because of the athlete's age, was not breaking the law, but you had concerns that the coach had been grooming that young gymnast and therefore ended up banning the coach. But because there was no criminal breach of law, even though your own rules had been broken because there was the relationship between the coach and the gymnast, and because you were concerned about grooming, you were able to ban the coach, but the coach could not then be subject to a criminal prosecution and wasn't barred, as far as you know, by the DBS.
That's correct. The issue of grooming is such a difficult one when it comes to sports coaching, because under the law, a coach isn't recognised as a position of trust. Like, if a teacher if a teacher is teaching a kid from the age of 10 to the age of 16 and then had a relationship with them once they reached the legal age, there would be a whole position of trust breach on in the law. But that doesn't apply to sports coaches. So the whole proof of grooming is more complicated in a sports coach situation.
Were you able to alert people in other sports then about the possible risk this coach posed of grooming of young gymnasts and athletes?
No, because that would be a breach of that person's right to privacy. So that's where the DBS service is supposed to come in.
And were you able to publish your findings and the ban for this coach on your website so that other people might find out about it?
The processes in British gymnastics were, while I was working, they were all under review. And one of the things that was heavily debated was this ideal of posting information online. It's a difficult one. Because,
well, in this case, Niall, was it posted online?
Not that I'm aware of, actually, no.
Niall, thanks very much indeed. Niall Carroll. In fact, most sports don't appear to publish details if they've barred a coach or official. And even when they do, like UK Athletics do, for example, they don't give a precise reason for the ban or any details of the allegations. They just named the disciplinary code that has been breached. Let's speak to Simon Mackay. Simon's a barrister who prosecuted a large number of serious sexual offences at sports disciplinary inquiries. Hi, Simon.
Good morning.
Do sports face a legal problem in being able to tell other people if an individual has been banned? Because they appear to think that there are all sorts of legal obstacles in the way of publishing.
Well, they certainly have to be careful from a legal point of view, but there is no prohibition on publishing, providing they approach it in the correct way. Keith Eldridge there, who was responsible for the prosecution of Alan Roberts, someone who I prosecuted in the disciplinary context, identified the Data Protection Act and the issues of confidentiality. But providing there is an overriding public interest, it is possible to, in principle, publish.
You would have thought that where there are serious, credible allegations, even if they're disputed, about potential abuse of a child or a vulnerable adult, there would automatically be an overriding public interest in making that known, wouldn't you?
No, I quite agree. And in the Roberts case, there was a very detailed ruling by an eminent QC who chaired the panel, who indeed, as one of his recommendations, invited the CPS to review criminal prosecution against him. So the Roberts case is probably a very good example of where the public interest seems obvious. Of course, one has to be careful not to publish details of juveniles and the minors that may have complained against the coach. But there are ways and means of doing that, perhaps by using initials for the complainants' names, for example. Mm. But I agree that very often in these cases, the public interest outweighs the issue of confidentiality towards the coach, and it should be published.
How well geared up are individual sports to tackle these difficult cases?
Well, it's very difficult. This was one of the first for British Judo, for example, and their handling of it was exemplary. They invested a great deal of money, time and resources to afford Mr. Roberts every fairness in terms of the process. He was represented himself by barristers and solicitors. It was really a model of its kind. The problem is that not all sports bodies are similarly equipped or well-resourced. Some organisations, like British Gymnastics, are very used to having to prosecute these types of cases and are better at it than some others. Organisations like the FA, also very good. But when you get down to the smaller organisations with less resources, then it does become much more problematic.
Simon, thanks for your time this morning. Barrister Simon Mackay. Getting your stories, comments and observations as well. Text us on 85058. You can email goldberg@bbc.co.uk. On Facebook, we're at BBC Five Live. The time now is 11:31.
This is BBC Five Live, available on the BBC iPlayer radio app. Five Live investigates.
Yeah, good morning. Welcome along if you've just joined us. Adrian Goldberg here with Five Live Investigates. Today, concerns about safeguarding in sport, especially for young people. We've discovered that the number of coaches, volunteers and officials who have been investigated by the government's disclosure and barring service has gone up fourfold in the last 4 years. The DBS can't tell us how many have led to someone being banned from working with children and vulnerable adults, nor how many of the allegations were of a sexual nature. What we do know, though, is that if the DBS decides to take no further action, details of an individual's behaviour won't be shared, allowing predators to carry on coaching in one sport, even if they've been banned in another. Getting lots of comment on this. One listener says, I was abused by two judo coaches back in the 80s. The other coaches knew it was happening. On residential courses, the girls were told by the other coaches to avoid being on their own with the worst of the two abusers. I was 13 when it started and 17 when I left judo. No one cares. Hearing all this on the news about abuses in sport is so hard. Another listener saying, I've got a lot of experience of this issue and would like to ask parents to report any abuse of their children and then persist until they get answers. And one more for now. Sports have been working for years through schemes like Clubmark and other schemes. The NSPCC have been working tirelessly. All this has led to greater awareness of the dangers, and I hope this means more people are being referred and caught, as shown in your figures. The systems are not perfect, but parents being aware is the most important element. We cannot keep children and people 100% safe, but with all people being aware, we can make it very hard for potential offenders. If you do want to email, it's goldberg@bbc.co.uk. You can text us on 85058 or on Twitter, we're at BBC5Live. Now, of course, safeguarding in sport is in the spotlight at the moment after a number of former professional footballers came forward at the end of last year to say they had been abused as youngsters. The National Police Chiefs Council is coordinating an investigation into historical abuse in football and is investigating 155 suspects. There are now 429 potential victims, some as young as four at the time of the alleged offence, and 148 clubs are now involved. Some of the ex-players who say they've survived abuse went on to form the Offside Trust, which aims to support others in the same situation as them and their families. Steve Walters, once of Crewe Alexandra, is one of the Trust's founders. So what's his assessment of the situation now?
There is still abuse going on in the game. Not as much, obviously, top of the range, but obviously working your way down the leagues, we're still aware that there is abuse still going on.
So how would you assess the level of safeguarding?
We're still being told and being made aware of that there's still shortfalls regarding the safeguarding within football especially.
So we've discovered that if a sport bans an individual but the disclosure and barring service decides not to bar them, then other sports organisations won't necessarily be made aware of that. What do you think of that?
I think that's absolutely shocking. Basically, someone gets barred from one sport for whatever reason, but you know, they've just got an open ticket to go into another sport and just do what they want there. So that needs addressing. If they can get barred from one sport and go safely into another, there's obviously a huge problem that needs addressing, really. So that needs to be looked at as a matter of urgency.
How do we deal with that situation? What's the answer to it, do you think?
Well, we need some sort of system that can, obviously, when they get barred from one sport, that can be broadcasted and put on, like the police records, for example. So all, each individual sport are aware of anybody who's abused in any sport or banned from any sport.
Some people might say, well, look, you know, it's right that an independent body like the DBS should decide whether someone should be prevented from working with children, not necessarily an individual sport.
That is a bit of a grey area, but if they do get investigated during one sport, we need to be a little bit more vigilant when they, you know, there is a question mark regarding them and they move to another sport. So they need to be investigated and closely monitored.
Do you think there should be one central body then for sharing of information between
sports? Yes, most definitely. That's you know, regarding the offside trust, something we're possibly we're going to look into. We've got some big meetings coming up and something we're definitely going to be taking a good look at ourselves.
I know you've been to the United States recently to look at safeguarding there. How does that differ from what we do here?
Yeah, the safeguarding over in the US is light years ahead of what we got here, really. There's mandatory reporting of any misdemeanours of anybody. If you don't report it, you can get yourself into trouble. So I think, you know, we need to take a good look at certain laws in this country as well, maybe.
Yeah, so there's kind of an obligation on you if you suspect any behaviour of a coach, a volunteer, an official, that you would have an obligation within
the sport
to report it.
That's right, yes. Yeah, crikey. After what's happened with us the last few months, I think everybody and anybody are now a lot more vigilant. But as we know from previous history, things die down and people's memories disappear, but it needs to be sorted out.
I think you've even raised the idea of body-worn cameras for coaches.
Yeah, that's an option, a bit like what the police force do. You know, maybe it could be piloted somewhere. If it's going to safeguard our children, maybe it's an idea that's something that is acted upon very, very soon.
There we go. Steve Walters from the Offside Trust. Now, throughout the programme, we've been hearing how when concerns are raised about an individual coach or volunteer, they aren't necessarily shared with other sports organisations or clubs, meaning that abusers can avoid detection. Steve Walters raising there the suggestion that we have some kind of centralised system across all sports, into which all of these concerns can be logged and passed on to other organisations. Let's get more now again from our reporter, Anna Riggs. And Anna, you've surveyed a number of sports organisations and asked about this specific question.
Yeah, we contacted the governing bodies for the top 25 sports in the UK by membership. And we asked them whether a central system for sharing information about coaching staff between different governing bodies would help safeguard children in sport. Of the 19 that responded, 14 of them said yes.
So pretty positive response there, clear majority of those who responded. You also asked those 25 sports governing bodies about whether or not they publicise the findings of internal disciplinary hearings relating to coaching staff and child safeguarding issues. What do they have to say about that?
Only two said that they do. Five of the bodies I contacted say they are in favour in principle, but they don't publish because of legal concerns around data protection and anonymity. England Golf said they're launching a new website in March, which will publicise all disciplinary cases, including the safeguarding ones. Badminton England told us they currently don't, but they are considering wider publication. And British Cycling are generally in favour of publishing, but have been advised not to because of the potential legal issues surrounding data protection and anonymity.
And that's come up quite a few times, hasn't it, in our conversation? So we did hear the barrister earlier saying that if there is an overriding public interest for publication, then those issues around data protection and anonymity should not preclude publication. Thanks for that, Anna. So how good are safeguarding measures in sport in the UK? Do we have the systems in place to protect children? Well, I'm joined now by Dr. Daniel Rind from Brunel University, whose research has been used to try and help implement a global standard for safeguarding, something called international safeguards for children in sport. Daniel, good morning to you.
Good morning, Adrian.
And also Mike Fisher from Sports Coach UK, which trains more than 20,000 coaches every year. Mike, we'll be with you in just a moment, but good morning. Daniel, do we have any idea of the true scale of abuse in sport?
Well, some research projects have been conducted. The NSPCC did a large survey within the UK in 2011 of 6,000 people that were now 18 looking back over their experiences, and that showed various percentages of the abuse that's happening that lead us to believe that there are a prevalence of a range of types of abuses. And the research that we did a few years ago looking at the cases managed by sport in the UK showed that in 1 year there were 652 cases being managed across all sport. So that research does tell us that there is an issue out there, but there needs much more work into data being collected by sport and being shared so we can have rigorous systems to really understand what the problem is that can then feed into our strategies to hope to address these problems.
I think part of what we've tried to do this morning is expose kind of possible loopholes in the safeguarding system, obviously with a view to ensuring better protection for young people, vulnerable adults as well. What do you regard as the key weaknesses at the moment in our safeguarding procedures?
I think those issues have been raised before the break there in terms of sports being able to share that information, because we know the characteristics that make a child vulnerable in sport aren't necessarily very different across all sports. So if somebody's shown inappropriate behaviour in one sport, those same characteristics that enable that behaviour will be prevalent in other sports. So the risks that have been talked about from them moving one sport to another, or even in a more global world that we're in at the moment, moving from outside of the UK into the UK, where it's much harder to check their background, where there may have been inappropriate events in their history, that information sharing is very difficult, both within sports to make sure that coaches don't move around different clubs within a sport, to across sports, moving between them, and both also internationally, where people coming from abroad where you might be able to look into their background as easily as we can do in this country. So that information sharing is a real challenge moving forward, I think.
Yeah. Mike Fisher from Sports Coach UK, how does the current system of vetting coaches work? I mean, do they all have to be licensed, for example?
A number of governing bodies have licensing schemes in place. About 25 governing bodies currently have licensing schemes in place. But in terms of the checking, those coaches that have are in a position of responsibility, a duty of care, do require to get a DBS check. And employers who use coaches are required to get those DBS checks to ensure that they are fit for purpose, albeit, you know, taking an appreciative perspective of some of the points that have been made by other people on your programme today, that it's not foolproof by any stretch of the imagination, but that's the process that people need to go through.
Sure. I mean, the question has been raised then about whether we should have a centralised system for licensing coaches, or at least logging concerns about coaches so that they're not free to move from one sport to another if concerns has been raised. Do we need a centralised licensing system?
Well, we've got a kind of a fledgling licensing system in place at the moment. So across those 25 governing bodies, a number have come forwards to be endorsed by us as an independent organisation. But what we don't necessarily have is a central database that underpins that. Mm. And most of those licensing systems, the safeguarding component of it is the DBS system itself. So there's a question around whether we should create another independent registration system such as the DBS to sort of fulfil some of the functions that potentially we're saying the DBS system doesn't fulfil at the moment, which is this area around the ones where it's not a criminal offence that's occurring, it's the balance of probabilities, as Adrian was sort of mentioning earlier, and where there is public interest in sharing that information. But I think I'd initially focus on looking at how we take best advantage of the current DBS system as opposed to looking at something alternative. There is something that we need to look at here that does ensure that we the people participating in sport and physical activity are accessing a safe environment first and foremost.
Yeah, Daniel, you've looked at kind of a kite mark system for sports to show they've reached a certain standard in relation to safeguarding.
Yes, in the UK, the Child Protection Sport Unit already has the three levels in terms of sport at a national level, being preliminary or intermediate or advanced. And what we've worked on is our international safeguards project is to try and consider ways in which sports can have a kite mark in place. But what I would say, going beyond kite mark, is that safeguarding is what you see in practice and the way in which people interact with children and whether there's a welfare officer who's active within the clubs. Safeguarding is not a logo on a website or a certificate on a wall. So you have to be careful in terms of saying that this club is safe and how you audit that and monitor that regularly, that presents very much challenges. So really safeguarding is about sports showing that they're committed and they're working towards something, rather than having a mark which says this club is safe, because you can never 100% be sure. You can always be moving towards a safer position.
Daniel Wright, Mike Fisher, thank you both very much indeed for getting involved. Getting some really interesting comments coming in on this morning. Sean in Cumbria says it is crucial to educate children early in the home and in the school, all the different ways to keep safe. It is doable sensitively, says Sean. Another listener saying, my son is 10 years old, plays for a local football team in Scotland. All their fixtures in the first 3 weeks of January have been cancelled because the club needs to register and re-register each January with the SFA. The process takes at least 3 weeks. No matches, not even friendly fixtures are allowed until the registration process has been completed. The bureaucracy is impacting upon the ability to enjoy the sport. And the final one for now, I'm on the other side of this debate in an influential position in a sports club. Allegations have been made against a coach. Police have investigated. The coach is on police bail. It is very hard to get to the substance of the allegations, but can't discover anything that sounds truly criminal, only maybe suspect. The police bail condition requires the coach not to work with children unsupervised, which presents real difficulties. The police have not decided to charge, nor have they dropped the case, so the coach is in a dire state of limbo, which I think is seriously unfair on the coach and anyone employing this person. Really interesting stuff. Keep them coming. Drop us a text to 85058 on Facebook, BBC 5 Live, or you can email goldberg@bbc.co.uk.
Take 5 Live on the go. On digital, online, smartphone and tablet. 5 Live investigates.
Just a quick update on the cricket, by the way. The one-day international, India against England in Pune. It's the break between the innings at the moment. England off their 50 overs were 350 for 7. A fine knock by Joe Root, who scored 78. Jason Roy, 73. India will be resuming taking up their innings very shortly. You can follow that over on 5 Live Sports Extra. Now, just before Christmas, we told you the story of Simon Rickards from Cheltenham, 42-year-old, suffering from anorexia. Simon, whose weight was dangerously low, had been waiting 10 weeks for a bed in a specialist inpatient unit, despite doctors saying he needed urgent care. There is a national shortage of these kind of beds anyway. But what makes Simon's problem worse is that because he's a man, most units can't take him because they are female only. He has been getting treatment in the community, but that is no longer enough.
The pattern of behaviour from the point where it was obvious that day treatment wouldn't work and the other treatment options available, it's just become clear that I need a sustained longer period of treatment as an inpatient. They obviously monitored how things went over sort of 4 or 5 weeks and basically realised that that's what I need, and at that point said, we're making a referral for you to have inpatient treatment again.
So when was that?
That's 8 weeks ago now.
So you were referred for inpatient treatment 8 weeks ago. Why am I now sitting in your flat in Cheltenham 8 weeks later talking to you rather than having this chat with you in a hospital bed?
Well, for two reasons primarily. One, there's a national shortage of inpatient beds, and two, because it's further complicated by the fact that a lot of units don't accept men, and of the ones that do accept men, usually they've only got one male bed available. If that male bed is available and they're running at capacity and a woman needs a place, they'll give it over to her. So that means my wait extends further.
Now, lots of you got in touch to offer Simon sympathy and to share similar difficult stories. Well, today, though, we have got good news to report. A bed has been found for him. He's currently getting treatment in a specialist eating disorder unit in Bristol, joined now by his mum, Carol Bettis. Morning to you, Carol.
Good morning.
So, it is good news. How long did it take Simon to be admitted into that specialist unit from his first referral?
It must have been about 12 or 13 weeks. He actually went there on January the 4th. It did go on a little bit longer, but he's
well,
there
indeed,
now.
When I spoke to him in his flat in Cheltenham, kind of in the middle of December, he said it'll definitely be after Christmas before he got into a place, and he was finally admitted. But what was it like for him being admitted?
It was a weight off his mind, obviously. He is finding it very hard. I went and visited him last week, but he is making small but very positive steps. We all know it's going to take time. He needs a lot of help and understanding, but the staff at the unit are amazing. So he definitely is in the right place.
How would you say he is now?
Struggling, but happy that he's obviously safe there, and he is getting the help that he so desperately needs.
And Carol, you've got a note which Simon wrote after he was admitted to the unit. Do you mind just reading a little sample of that for us?
Yes. Christmas and New Year were hard on one hand, but easy on another. Easy in that I detached from the whole event and just isolated myself in much the same way as I have the whole time I've been ill. The hardest part was knowing that there were families the length and breadth of the country doing all the things I wished I could have, and the memories of better times came to the fore. But I do know there are people in far worse situations than I, but at times I couldn't help being acutely aware of the effect that my condition was having on me and how much it was stopping me from having normality and enjoying what is meant to be a time when togetherness is celebrated. I remember thinking that I never want another festive period to be like that again. But now I'm in the unit, I'm even more aware of just how ill I am. It's too early to say how things will be, and I feel exceedingly fragile in every conceivable way, not to mention vulnerable to the very thing that has brought me here. That said, everybody has been exceptionally kind, supportive, and the staff are incredibly skilled at what they do. I feel very isolated from the real world. Contact with my family has been confined to just texting at the moment. I feel it's important that I focus on getting well and trying to find my path to recovery, but I know this will take time. I hope the real world will be there when I get through this, if I can get through this. It's going to be a battle, a hellish one, but I'm where I need to be.
Oh, and Carol, I should say that when I spoke to Simon, one thing you did pay tribute to was your support, and you know, you clearly love him dearly, doing whatever you can to try and help him. How does it feel to you reading through that?
I've read through it several times, so there's no tears this time. But he's very, very brave. He's very brave, and he will get through this. I know he will. Got every confidence he'll get through this, but it can't be rushed.
He certainly has our best wishes. Do pass those on to him, Carol. Thank you very much indeed. Lots more comments coming in about the disclosure and barring service as well, and loopholes that might allow abusers in sport to progress. Richard says it's not up to the sport to decide whether an offence has occurred, so allegations should always be reported to the police. Once it's reported, it will show up on an enhanced police check. Thanks for listening to the 5 Live Investigates podcast. Got a few more of your texts and emails to mop up before we go. Lucy from Derby picking up on the point that in some cases, even though a coach may be barred from a particular sport, that might not be put on a website to notify other people because it's not deemed to be in the public interest. Lucy says, how is danger to children not in the public interest? That is an insult to society. Name and shame all those who are a threat to our children. Arthur in Liverpool says charitable trusts have a legal whistleblower duty of care. I don't understand why sports see themselves as any different. JD in Plymouth says, in light of the recent failed government inquiries into historical child abuse, it is becoming obvious that organisations like the DBS are more about protecting abusers than children. It is time for decisive action to restore confidence in these legislative bodies. Thanks very much indeed for those. And don't forget, in the meantime, if there's something you want us to investigate, you can email goldberg@bbc.co.uk.
on digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
bbc.co.uk/5live.